that mentors are a community of women from an unspecified place in time. In many ways, they're an example of communism in its purest form, as they seem to have done away with the family unit. The latter, for Marx and Engels, was where patriarchy and capitalism work in tandem to produce willing, alienated workers, and where women become little more than instruments of production. In their culture, women's voices were only allowed to be heard during private funeral ceremonies whilst grieving their dead. Outside lamenting, being heard in public was a punishable offence by wearing the scold's bridle. Scold was defined as a rude woman, a shrew, and this iron cage was designed to cause public humiliation and great discomforts to the wearer, worn for several hours in order to prevent them from eating, drinking, and most importantly, talking. That went into the mouth to hold down the tongue recalls a horse bridle used to enable the rider to exercise control over the animal. In lamentation, women were allowed an isolated moment of speaking out, as they were not to be interrupted at any cost during the build-up of a lament. Lamenters would often deviate from the particular death they were mourning and move to other, private or public matters, commonly untouchable by women. It seems to be the reason behind the entire female population practicing lamenting, and why eventually the latter becomes detached from its traditional association with death and extrapolated to its quotidian state. Mourning is the main mode of vocal communication in this community today. Though words may be spoken, there is another level of significance in the gaps where speech is either lost or becomes irrelevant, as their voice devolves into inarticulacy, what Caballero calls a moan, a cry, vocal expressions at once sorrowful and joyous, otherworldly and therefore extremely dangerous.
И наше счастье, которое Он дал нам, оно не ушло от нас, оно живет в нас, как живут в нас. Не только Его прекрасно.
It is yet unclear how the lamenters eventually established a state within a state and a new language within these confines. Echoing Vina Das, how does one not simply articulate loss through a dramatic gesture of defiance, but learn to inhabit the world, or inhabit it again, in a gesture of mourning? The threat lamenting is perceived to pose to the social order is due to the extreme uncertainty that such an orgiastic state of grief carries with it. The demonization of ecstatic experience and privileging of rationality as the only reliable form of consciousness is part of Western civilization's inauguration of an autonomous, secular, and industrious self. Labeled enthusiasm, associated with primitive cultures, portrayed as the anti-self of the Enlightenment, as Jules Evans explains. The banning of ecstasy is at the core of the European colonialist project. In his book, The Art of Losing Control, Evans maps out 3 centuries of Western culture's efforts to condemn and eliminate ecstatic experience by attributing it to the nervous temperament or weak education of women, the working class, and people of color. From the Enlightenment to 19th century imperialism, the emergence of psychiatry as a discipline, and neoliberalism's ideological emphasis on privatization, individual liberty, and invention of market-driven economies from the late 80s onwards, the denigration of public, collective, and joyful modes of living is not accidental or arbitrary, but a systematic process. As the late cultural critic Mark Fisher shows in Baroque Sunbursts, the infamous Criminal Justice and Public Order Act of 1994, for the regulation of partying under legislation that relied on the ludicrously vague term repetitive beats, is an attack on the joy of collectivity that begins with the birth of capitalism. Of the individual submerging her identity in the chorus is one way to come to terms with being human. At the same time, for Nietzsche, tragedy is the highest form of art because of the role of the chorus in helping the audience to turn thoughts of repulsion at the horror and absurdity of existence into ideas compatible with life. The chorus and its lamenting transport us to a state of wisdom, i.e. intuition mediated through music, rather than mere knowledge, i.e. reason and reasoning. Genuine knowledge is always tragic and unendurable, collective and ecstatic, aesthetic and musical. Art is both an intimation of the horror of reality and a consolation for it. In The Art of Lamentation, the chorus is ceaseless song, fringe, is a combination of articulate and inarticulate utterances of the voice at the expense of the melodies. Against the dialectical optimism of man as the rational animal, the lamenters demand the right to opacity. Their voices are uncontained by the imposed boundaries that emerge in the relay between self, world, and representation, as Fred Moulton says about Aunt Hester's scream in Black and Blue. The lament's content is not simply unrepresentable, but instantiates, rather, an alternative to representation. In excess and disruption of meaning, of the modality of subjectivity that makes and interprets meaning. The chorus reveals voice as a force reducible neither to an act nor to its agent. It engenders a polyvocal, elastic language, nurturing, as Idea Hartman writes, a radical imagination that dares think of other narratives written from nowhere. In her book, Wayward Life's Beautiful Experiments, Hartman devises a chorus through which the everyday anarchy of ordinary black girls resists the power and authority of the alpha and the limits it sets on what can be known, whose perspective matters, and who is endowed with the gravity and authority of a historical actor. Hartman works with unknown persons, nameless figures, ensembles, collectives, multitudes, the chorus. Marvel at their capacity to inhabit every woman's grief, she writes. For Hartman, as for her castle, the chorus bears all of it for us. We sacrifice it to action. It is there to act out our grief, without us having to sacrifice ourselves or our kin having to die. This is a polyphonic assembly, calling for the destruction of the primal oneness of the tragic hero or great man inside the whole. A concept borrowed from music, which literally means multiple voices. Polyphony, after Mikhail Bakhtin, refers to an interaction by numerous simultaneous voices unmerged into a single perspective and not subordinated to the voice of the author. Polyphony is about an unlimited openness of the voice to develop into unpredictable futures. As Bakhtin says, nothing conclusive has yet taken place in the world. The alternate word of the world and about the world has not yet been spoken. Everything is still in the future and will always be in the future. Emerges as an outdated and invalid philosophical category, in dire need of replacement by its plural counterpart. Voices residing outside and beyond language, unhinged from nationality, occupying worlds in which there is no meaning other than sound, allow for the activation and emergence of alternative narratives. The momentous demand that we engage with a redefinition of time, occupying the gaps in the archive, collectively generating spontaneous, dissonant space that rejects a specific social trajectory. Certain vocalities are entangled in all human history. As logocentrism is invented and established by the patriarchy, one of its chief tactics from antiquity to present day, is an ideological association of female, inanimate, and animal sounds with monstrosity, disorder, and death. The lamenters rejoice in the dangers of the illogical, irrational, and indeterminate qualities bestowed. Having been consistently excluded from the category of the human voices, they are ideally positioned to tap into and mobilize the alienness and otherworldliness of the human as a category. In its refusal to communicate in the language of the master and participate in its production of absolute truths about the other, the chorus generates knowledge of another kind, non-human thinking.
Non-human thinking.